Summary of a book I was teaching in India called Brihat Bhagavatamrita. It can be called like the greatest story ever told. Is that used already? Sometimes I'm good at branding and sometimes I plagiarize. But first, I have an inspiration. So I'll speak about the inspiration. Okay. Ram Sadowski's coming. I love the name. But she shouldn't sit on the floor, though. She can sit up there. Okay. Just bring Ram Sadowski out, show everybody, give blessings to Ram Sadowski.
You make us kirtan, right?
He's, Oh, you want me to do it publicly? Okay. You see, Ram Sadowski is here. Okay. I love the name Ram Sadowski. It would be. It sounds like Moshe Crigliano. Let's go. Okay, for you like that joke. Do you only like the Italian jokes?
No, I love them.
But especially the Italian.
Yeah, I mean, Jewish is serious.
So my inspiration, I'll start. It's about New Jersey. I want to say some good things about New Jersey for a change. But I first, very beautiful job, really, really beautiful job. I wanted to say something about my next Monday morning greetings, which was a tough one. I'm still not finished with it. I was writing it up until I came here. I was writing it. Sometimes they become difficult. And it's called Seeing Through the Eyes of the Q Train. Get it? Seeing Through the Eyes of the Shastra, right? Q Train. But it was... it was kind of, you know, like a realization I had. I'm not going to give away the whole thing. It's kind of interesting. It talks a lot about mind reading. There's actually a science of mind reading. There's two scientists that they isolated 3,000 different combinations of muscle movements on the face that universally correspond to emotions. It's very, very interesting. To the extent that this guy was said he would go into a post office and see criminal, you know, most wanted posters, and looking at the face, tell what crime the person did. Whether it was a bank robber or a rapist, you know, like embezzler. It was very interesting. So I was talking about that, you know, I like to try to do that sometimes. Don't get scared. But I, you know, because I was riding the train. I haven't, you know, I was staying in New York, so I was walking every place. So I was on the Q train. I said, let me study the people. And then, you know, I was next to these Orthodox Jews. And they're not Hasidic. But, you know, there was, you know, a few couples and a lot of children. And I saw that they were relatively, compared to the general people who ride trains, they were generally kind of carefree and happy and like that. I kind of noticed this starkly. And then I was noticing also that not just reading minds, you know, by seeing people's faces, but I had the extra tool of seeing the world through knowledge, because I've studied a tradition of knowledge for like, oh, you know, almost 50 years. So it wasn't going, or should I start again? It was working or not?
There's a problem with the sound, but it's all
right. People were hearing, but not so good.
Yeah, we're all right now.
What? You okay?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. So, hey. Chitananda, good to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you too.
Okay. So, we call it the eyes of the Shastra. So I saw how it's not just important to see things clearly, but it's how you understand or evaluate them. It's not just being perceptive and seeing something, but actually evaluating it. And I saw how when you're connected to a body of knowledge, you can actually evaluate things properly. So I started to, and this is the point I wanted to relate, I started to, you know, see, you know, why were they relatively carefree? I'm not making a statement like on all Orthodox Jews, you know, the hierarchical systems, you know, have a tendency for abuse. People are fanatics. Not everybody represents. But I just saw there was something there that, you know, there was a lot of nice relationships between the parents and the children, different ages and things. And then I saw, you know, what is the Shastra? The Shastra presents spirituality, but within the context of a community and traditions. And then I was saying, what is a community and a tradition? And I wrote about this before, that there are foundational principles of stability that previously used to be supplied without effort. People would have to fend for themselves. They would start life with this. And the four things was, one is your residence, where you're going to live and stay, and the community that you're part of. Who is your partner in life? What is your career according to your nature? And what is your spiritual path?
Okay.
It's working. Okay. Okay.
And what is your and what is your is it working?
It's working. Yeah, okay. It's working. Everybody, it's working. Okay.
And what is your spiritual path? And in modern life, you have to fend for yourself. They're not things that are provided for you. You have to fend for yourself, and it takes a lot of energy to do that. And it creates a constitutional situation of anxiety in the modern world, because those things are not provided. And then after that, so, and I analyze kind of some of the reasons why, you know, community and tradition and finding that stability is important. One thing is, when you're in functional groups, you can think about common interest rather than individual interest. And that helps you transcend the limited concept of I that's the source of all anxiety. And then I also talked about what I saw is the degree of functional relationships. And there was that also leads to well-being and happiness. And I saw that also in... And I referenced a study from Harvard University, an 80-year study they did. It's 80 years going on, where they tracked 400 people, half from Harvard and half from South Philly, South Boston, different types of people. And they just did studies on them, and they followed them their whole lives. And then they said, well, what was the factor that gave them, for example, health? Right? Diet was important, exercise was important, but it wasn't the most important thing. The most important thing was the number of quality relationships they had in their lives. That was the most important factor. So I, like that, and just the conception that when you have tradition and community, it's much easier to think that the world is not just about me and all these factors. So I was discussing the point of seeing things, and this is what I was seeing through the eyes of Shastra. So now let's say a good thing about New Jersey. No, it's a nice community. You know, it's just a nice community of people that you know, they... Jersey, right, Tom? Toto, they work hard in Jersey, right?
You don't have a choice.
People work hard, they raise families, and, you know, there's the challenges of life, but it's nice that there's a spiritual community and stable relationships and whatever challenges are, things in life that help people just transcend a little bit, you know, of the limited concept of I. We belong to families, we have communities, we have responsibilities, you know. There's a famous author named Tom Wolfe, satirist. He's one of the great satirists. Great, I mean, his articles are unbelievable. He's probably the best satirical writer. I mean, the things he wrote is... So he wrote one article, I spoke about this before, called The Me Generation. That's my generation. My parents' generation was called the greatest generation. You know, they all, my uncles, they fought in the war, they sacrificed their lives, one of my uncles died in the war. You know, the sense of people who actually, you know, went through the Depression, the people who had challenges, and then my generation was called the me generation. All of a sudden, we became obsessed with self-improvement, which is okay, but it was all about ourselves. So he made a point there that really struck me. He said, they'll never understand duty above self. It's a challenge. But It's psychologically healthy. And happiness is more internal than it is in your environment itself. Because we see people who don't have that sense of duty above self, and a lot of times people who become famous and they become carried away from themselves. You know, the biggest movie stars, they wind up depressed. They're all in mental health things. We can't do this. You know, because they were so self-centered that they disconnected themselves from the center. They were so self-centered they disconnected themselves from the center, because that's not our real self. Our real self is not the center. Our real self is serving the center. So you somehow or other you think that these people have everything in the world imaginable, then therefore they can control the world and fulfill their desires much better than you can. You would think that, you know, they would become more happy. But actually we see they become more disconnected from the self. When I grew up, and if anybody remembers this, you're going to reveal your age, it may be embarrassing to you. But there used to be this television show we watched called The Millionaire. And it was this guy, Mike, and you know, there was this big benefactor, and you only see his back. And the beginning of the show, Mike would come into his office and say, "You're next millionaire." You know, and at that time, $1 million, it was a lot of money. Maybe a lot of money now, but it's not a lot of money. And then he would go to this house and they'd give him $1 million, and then you watch. And the theme was always that money can't buy happiness. It doesn't deal with the core self. So, and I remember even time when Kasturba made one point, he was appreciating when one ISKCON late leader who was a sannyasi fell away from the path, you know, and he was actually appreciating the people in New Jersey. And they did their duty, they're steady, and you know, and after 10, 20, 30 years, they're still there. And you have so many shooting stars. And you know, and the advancement goes in increments, and people put, so it's actually, and what I like to do is help by helping, you know, making a community. And these kind of events are kind of really, they're just really relishable. And I'm going to do it at least once a month here, once a month in New York, and that's my program called Rasa Japa. I tried Rasa Japa in Colombia, but it didn't work. Because the Colombians, yeah, when music starts to go, they're like Gales people. When the music starts to go, it's just like, it's Rasa Kirtan. Rasa Kirtan was more suitable for Colombia. It just happened the first day I did it. There was just a lot of children around sitting in the thing, and I couldn't actually do Rasa Japa. But I also thought for the Colombians, you know, it's just a little beat and everything is going. So, but today we'll do Rasa Japa. So the idea of Rasa Japa is that absorption, our absorption in meditation, which means Krishna in the name, and this is our faith that Krishna is the name. We don't have to think of things. It'll distract us. We just want to concentrate on the name. Because it's Krishna, and within Krishna is his form, quality, and pastimes. So we just want to become absorbed in the name. And the greatest absorption between two objects, two beings, is called sambandha. Sambandha means relationship. You're most absorbed in the object of your relationship when there's love. So Betty, you were saying in that Simon Haas class, you read his book, and then something happened like, wow, you can love Krishna.
Well, when I read his book, I was going through a terrible midlife crisis. And so his book is about that period in your life where it's like the darkest period. It's The Dark Night of Your Soul, that's the name of the book. And there was something, I'm trying to remember what it was, that I finally kind of got it. You know, I connected with it. And, you know, being able to love Krishna as a friend, as a lover, as a son, you know, it was just the way he wrote it. It really helped.
And you got that realization.
Yes.
And that realization is the essence of bhakti. So we develop that relationship with Krishna by hearing about Krishna. And Prabhupada said the process is reading and chanting. So when you read about Krishna and you hear about Krishna, you develop the sambandha. And so I said that, you know, rasa japa means I'll tell about Krishna, and that bhav, that meditation, that love or devotion that you get from hearing about Krishna, then we'll have japa and I'll have guided meditation, and we can kind of connect the two and put it in. It's also, as you know, I'm expert in branding. You almost hired me one
yes,
time.
Yes, well, I did hire you.
So, it's that connection. By the way, Simon Haas, you know, in the Bhakti Center, they were studying this book, and everybody's coming to me, wow, this book is so great. This book is so great. And I'm saying, well, these are devotees, and they're getting this devotional message, but who is Simon Haas? So I became really kind of puzzled. So I wanted to look him up. And then when I looked him up, I went, Simon Haas. And then I remember like 25, 30 years ago, when he was 17 or 18, he was sent to India. And I was helping to, you know, guide him at that time. So Betty's going to bring him to New York. Maybe we'll...
Yeah, he's coming.
So I'll speak to you. I have some ideas about where you can do a program.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. So now, Brihat Bhagavatamrita. I'm going to tell a little bit about this. If I can summarize the story in a short time, because I don't like to speak so long. And we want to do.
Oh.
Okay, I'll speak 15 minutes. So it's very interesting. It begins when the grandson of, I believe, Arjuna, Janamejaya, I think he's the son of Abhimanyu, who is the son of Arjuna. So he's studying with this great sage. It's in line from Arjuna. I think Arjuna's son was Abhimanyu, and Abhimanyu's son was Prikshit, I think. I'm getting the fact. Anyway, let's not get distracted here. We can. Anyway, I'm just going to look it up for a second. It's okay.
Yeah.
What? Now let me get it. I'll get it right for you right here. I got it in the tip of my hand. Green Bhagavatamrita. Part one, Bhumi the Earth. I'll just get it. Bear with me, once I get going, the story is going to be really interesting. I see the group is a very elevated group that wants to hear more. Okay. He's the son of Marge Prickett. The son of Marge Prickett is Jenna Magia. So Marge Prickett was the king. So he's continuing the dynasty. And he's hearing this Mahabharata. Mahabharata is the great history of India. And he's hearing it from Jaimini Rishi. And Jaimini Rishi was in charge of Vyasadeva when he divided the Vedas in four. He put that under, the Samaveda under Jaimini Rishi. So this is like, I'll use indirect logic. He's no slouch. Very powerful, powerful sage. So he's explaining to Jenamejaya the Mahabharata. And after he finishes, Jenamejaya is stunned because it's not the same Mahabharata that we've heard by Vaishapayana. It's not the same Mahabharata. So what it means is the Mahabharata's a history of India, but this one, you know, because it says the Mahabharata that we read is kind of for the less intelligent people. This one is, and it doesn't really directly present Krishna except in the Bhagavad Gita, in that, you know, in the level that Krishna is revealed, for example, in the Bhagavatam. But this Mahabharata, Krishna is much more prominent. It's the same book, but you know, you can present the same message for different audiences. You can have the same message with different stories. So the Mahabharata, it's the message. Just like you give a Bhagavatam class and you may mention so many contemporary things, it's still the Bhagavatam, it's the Bhagavatam class. But according to your audience, you may use now contemporary examples. So in that way, these great scriptures can kind of vary in how they're presented. You know, it's described that, you know, there's Vedas in billions of verses, and the Vedas are divided in four. So it's really a message, and great souls can reform the message. So he's stunned. He says, this is incredible. This is nectar. Nectar. he really was appreciating this. It's like, and he said, is there a kila? A kila means you can summarize a book in another book. So the kila for the Mahabharata is the Harivams. So he said, do you have something like that for this? Right? And then Jaimini Rishi says, yes, I do. And that happens to be the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. And then he begins to tell the story of the Brihat Bhagavatamrita. And this story has just so many, so many levels. It's so intricately composed. Thematically, it's so exciting and so dynamic. And it's composed by someone in their head as they're walking through the forest of Vrindavan. Because once they write, in those days, no word processor, and no big pens. It's you got like a piece of bark, and you got to scrape the indentations in, and then take some flowers and crush it in such a way that it's ink. So you can imagine what it is just to write a verse. Because you have no word process, it has to be in your mind. And then, because, you know, you got to do everything you do on the word process in your mind. So then you have to think, what's the next verse? How does it fit in? So basically, they're composing this whole thing in their minds, thematically, and how. So what happens is, he begins to tell the story. And the story is Maharaj Parikit had just heard the Bhagavatam from Sukadeva Goswami. What did that mean? It means he had 7 days left to live. The Bhagavatam was spoken in 7 days, and after it was spoken, then he had to assimilate and apply the knowledge to face death, because the message of the Bhagavatam is, what is the duty of a man who's about to die, and what should he not do? And then it says, and then it gives the message. It's about death. It's about fixing your consciousness in transcendence. So now he's heard the message. And even at the very end, he still wasn't fixed. He had to be tested. The message had to be nailed in for him. And so he's finished. And, you know, he's kind of getting ready now. You know, he has a short time left. And who shows up but his mother? Of course, who's my mother? This is how it would be. You know, my last day, my mother shows up, and I would go like this. Not now. And then there would be this whole thing, and then I'd leave the body and argue with my mother. That would be the end of the story. But Maharaj Parikit, you know, his mother comes, that's Uttara, and she's a very, very elevated soul. She's a very, very elevated soul. And he understood that the mother wasn't coming just out of attachment. She was coming because she wanted to hear what he had heard. So he agrees that he will sum up the Bhagavatam for his mother. So what the Brihat Bhagavatamrita is a summary of the Bhagavatam. And instead of, you know, 18,000 verses, it's probably, I don't know, like 1,000 verses or something. It's much shorter. And it's summed up not in the same story form, but another story that explains the exact same message of elevating the consciousness gradually in different levels of intimacy of Krishna until you understand, you have the frame of reference, you have the detachment, and you have the knowledge to actually understand Krishna and his dancing with the gopis. So it's in a whole different, so he begins to tell the story. And it's such a fascinating story, and it begins at Kumbh Mela. This year, that's the festival in the month of Magh, which is basically January in India. And Mela means festival. And it's generally every 12 years. Every year there's something, but not as big. But there's also every 6 years. And now the chief minister of UP, who's Adityanath, he's a sadhu in saffron, the chief minister. So he decided to hold it really big this year also at the halfway mark. And what that means is, and this is the miracle of India, that means they'll construct on the confluence of the Jamuna, the Saraswati, and the Ganga, Triveni, the three rivers. So the unique part about the three rivers is there's a tremendous area of riverbank that you can't construct on. Because also during this rainy season, the rivers get bigger. So they construct a city there for 1 month, a functional city. It's amazing. And on the auspicious bathing days, they maybe 25, 30 million people come. Yeah, and they all bathe at the same time. It's amazing how it does. Mystic power. I went many, many years ago. I went. It was an amazing, amazing experience. The bath was just spiritually elevating. It's incredible. And every great spiritual organization, great sadhus, Prabhupada said, even from the Himalayas, people come under the water and show up there. Mystic yogis, they all come there. So Narada Muni came to the Kumbh Mela thousands of years ago, and he's before the deity there of Bindu Madhava, and he's with great sages, great saints. And great saints are humble because they're always meditating on God and therefore never have the misconception that I'm absolute. They see their relative position. And it fills their heart with love. So they don't have a lack of self-esteem, even though they don't consider themselves very great, because they feel loved. And that's the greatest self-worth. So they feel tremendously loved. And they're ecstatic. And they tend to want to glorify each other. And everyone is saying, you know, you're the greatest devotee, and you're the greatest devotee, and everyone is deflecting the praise. And in the midst of all this, this Brahmin, they see him walking into the Kumbh Mela, into that particular area. He's obviously a very aristocratic Brahmin because he's surrounded by a retinue of people, and he sits down and he starts with the mud making a altar, and he takes out a little cloth and he takes out his shalagram shila, and Narada is watching this and he begins to worship, and Narada can feel the love that this person has for the deity, and then he hears the person start to sing his songs and sing his mantras, and there's like so much devotion. And then Narada is just watching, and then he sees the person finish, and then he starts calling all the people. He calls the children and the Brahmins and the women and different people, and he starts feeding everybody. And then and then the dogs and the dog eaters, and you know, he's just, and then when he finishes this whole worship, he looks at the deity and with such sincerity he says, whatever benefit I get from this worship, I offer back to you. And Narada is just like, wow. So, one thing about devotion and bhakti is as you advance, the most important thing in your life, the thing that you're most enthusiastic for, is sadhu sangha, the association of advanced devotees. So he begins, Narada is so enthusiastic, and he runs, and he just looks at him, and he just says, Haribo, you are the greatest recipient of Krishna's mercy. Because how do you have so much devotion in your heart? Krishna must love you so much. He must see your sacrifice and he must pour his... You are the greatest recipient of Krishna's mercy. And the Brahmin goes, Me Bhakta Nehu. So many languages I speak. Spanish, Hindi, what is it I can't do? Me Bhakta Nehu. I'm not a devotee. And why? Because he's so he's so satisfied in love that he doesn't want to move from that egoless position. He's satisfied in being loved. And the analogy I thought of is like a baby in a mother's arms.
If the baby would think, I'd like to be, you know, I'd like to be holding you. Who are you? So the baby is very satisfied in love and devotion. Or like Hanuman. Hanuman said, if liberation means that I become God, I don't want to be liberated because I want to eternally remain your servant. Love is is the epitome of humility, because you're accepting another person's authority, not as your like a position of authority, but in terms of their desires ruling your life. A mother is very humble with the child, because whatever the baby wants, they have to move. So if they really have love, mother is very humble position. They are ruled by the desire of this little thing here. They're completely ruled. I want, I'm sick, you know. And they just, it's a humbling position. But when you're feeling love, you don't want to change that identity. So the Brahmin was legitimately humble and didn't want to move that position. So he said, I'm not a devotee. I'm not a devotee. And they felt that way too. Because they so much want God that it's like a hunger in their heart that makes them feel without the very thing they want, even though they have it. But they have God, but it just increases the desire. I want God. I want God. And it makes them feel that the very thing they have, they don't have. So people with a lot of devotion, they don't think they're devotees. And one who has none, they think they're very advanced. So you say, you want to say, you go see the king. Because I'm, you know, I have a family, I'm engaging everybody in Krishna. You can't believe this king. This king is so advanced that he doesn't own anything in the kingdom. He put everything in the kingdom legally under the deities and the care of the Brahmins. And if you go anywhere in this kingdom, everyone is happy and chanting Hare Krishna. If you go anywhere in this kingdom, there's festivals, there's prasadam. You got to see this king. You want to see a devotee, you go see the king. So in this way, the Brihat Bhagavatamrita, Narada is searching for the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy. And in every single place he goes, the same reaction is there. And points to another devotee who in some aspect is more intimate. It doesn't mean their love is not perfect. There are gradations of love in the spiritual world, but it doesn't mean that one is not perfect. Like a mother may have a relationship with her son, and the son may have a very intense relationship with a girlfriend or the wife, which may be more intimate than with the mother. But the mother's love is still perfect. So they go. So what happens in Brihat Bhagavatamrita, and why it follows the same path as the Bhagavatam, because that's what the Bhagavatam is. The Bhagavatam progressively explains different levels of intimacy of love of Krishna. It starts with creation, which is a love of Krishna that's very distant. It doesn't even have the aspect of service, because you see God in such majesty and such imminence that there's no conception of service. It's God. He doesn't need anything. So all there is prayers. Give an example of like someone becomes the fan of a famous music band. You know, they in the audience they go, oh, yeah, yeah. They don't do any service, but yeah. So Shantaraj is just like appreciation. You appreciate God. So it goes on in different things, and you'll see he meets Prahlad. And Prahlad, he's just blown away by Prahlad's service. But Prahlad looks at him and says, what service do? I just pray. You want to see a devotee, go to Hanuman. Then he goes to Hanuman. So in this way, it's the same thing as the Bhagavatam in a different story. But it's meant to ultimately come to Vrindavan, which has the most intimate love. Eventually it comes to Vrindavan. And I'll just give a little bit, the scene... How it points to Vrindavan is very, very interesting because Narada Muni is in Hastinapur and Ugrasena says, if you want to see the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy, you go meet Uddhava. Because who is Uddhava? Uddhava is Krishna's confidant. He's his Parishad. Parishad means like you have a servant, but he becomes your he's like your friend. So it's almost Braja Bhakti, but not. It's almost Vrindavan Bhakti. He is so intimate with him. So Narada is like, wow, there's even someone higher. Let me go see Uddhava. So Narada begins to run. And he enters into Dwarka. Now, if you see how Krishna's Dwarka is constructed, it's like a maze of streets. So if you want to find Krishna's palace, it's like... It's like trying to find something in New Delhi. it's not like Avenue A, Avenue B, C, first, second, third, fourth. It's like N block, O block, no block, Z block, A block. A2, you know, Lajpat Naga 1, Lajpat Naga 2, it's impossible. Or it's like getting stuck on the highway in New Jersey. Because once you get in the wrong turn, there's no way to get back. Because usually in a normal state, you get the wrong turn and you can make a left and go right. But there's no lefts in New Jersey. You have to go off. And sometimes that off doesn't connect to where you are. So you get the wrong... My GPS went crazy in New Jersey because I was by the Holland Tunnel and there's so many little streets next to each other. I was just going around. Who else can compare this the Dwarka to New Jersey? It's amazing. How did I just do that? That was I just compared. But it's a fact. If you get off, it's not a place to work. You get off in Jersey and you want to go back, there's no getting back. Because you can't make a left, you can only make a right. But sometimes you make a right, it doesn't come back. I've seen that. So anyway, there's a maze there. Those who are watching, all the people in New Jersey now are smiling with pride. It's in the audience. Wow. It's just like the walk-up. So, Narada Muni's coming into the palace. So he's coming into the palace, and it's a maze. But he's just... And he's intoxicated. He's not even like full consciousness. And somehow he gets to Krishna's palace. And then they say, well, maybe he was there before, but no one remember this. It's just he was on a different level. There's a level of bhakti, a high level of bhakti where you're moved by God. It's not an intellectual process. Therefore, in the Bhagavatam, there is verses that say, in the Bhagavatam, there are verses that say, you know, Sukadev may or may not know. There's these verses. Deiti na deiti. They may know, they may not know. What it means is that at a certain level of devotion, you become an instrument for Krishna, and Krishna can move through you. Even I see with Prabhupada, and I have this personal realization, if I look back at the things, the decisions he made, sometimes, if I was there, I would think, well, I think if we do it this way, or do this way, or, you know, everybody has an idea how Prabhupada should, the temple of Vedic Planetary, you know, you should make an eco village, you know, because of this, and there's so many good reasons. But when history goes out, you see what Prabhupada did worked. Somehow or other, it spread Krishna consciousness over the world, and it's a gift that keeps on giving. And his legacy continues. So it was a different thing. Krishna was moving through him. So he's moving through Narada, and Narada gets to the palace, and he wants to see Uddhava. And when he gets there, sitting outside of Krishna's room is Uddhava and his brother Baladev, and Baladev's mother Rukmini, and Krishna's wife Satyabhama, and Krishna's wife Rukmini, and there's a whole group there outside of Krishna's room on this day. And Narada comes in as a madman, intoxicated with love of Godhead. He's so enthusiastic that I will see the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy. He's so enthusiastic. That he's out of, not out of his mind, I would say out of mind. And they, you know, they look because Narada Muni. What does Muni mean? Muni means from Mauna. The term Muni, which means sage, is from the word for silent. Sages are silent. Sages are sober. So when you say someone is a Muni, a great Muni, it's not gregarious. Not emotional, but here he is complaining. They're like stunned. What's going on with Narada Muni? So they get up, you know, they wipe his face, they bring him, and he says, I am looking for the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy, Uddhava. Where is Uddhava? I want to see Uddhava. And Uddhava's like right there. But he's such in an emotional state, he doesn't see Uddhava. And then Uddhava realizes he's looking for the topmost devotee. And he thinks it's me. And then through his mind, he begins to think of who is topmost devotee. He begins to think of Bhishmadev and Kapila Muni, and he begins to think of Radharani, and he begins to... He's just his mind. He said, me, the topmost devotee? And look at that. It's like he just immediately begins to think of all these great, great devotees. And he becomes overwhelmed with dainya. And dainya means utter humility. That's another way in which humility is engendered in the heart. One way humility is engendered in the heart is if you receive mercy and you can accept it. Because when you receive mercy, it means what? I got more than I deserved. If you don't get more than you deserve, then it's not mercy. So when you get a lot more than you deserve, it's mercy. It means what? I don't deserve. So what happens? You have to look at what you're lacking. So it's another blissful feeling, actually, of getting mercy, even though it's very humbling. Because it means I'm getting what I don't deserve. I'm receiving love from this person. I'm receiving love for this person. I don't deserve it. So you feel like humble, but you feel so loved. But then his emotions, now Uddhava becomes overwhelmed with so many emotions. And then from this emotion, he becomes spiritually jealous. Because now he says, well, I like to have what they have. But it's all connected to Krishna and love and devotion. So his heart is just churning with all this emotion, all this devotion. And Uddhava just feels very, very humble. I don't really remember the whole story. Let me see if I can remember what happens next. Yeah, then Uddhava, then he says, because at the same time he has this Guru Nishtha. He's fixed it. And you have to, this is very advanced platform where it's highly emotional, but the emotion is not born from material frustration and material desire. It's born from love of Godhead. So then he has this thing, I guess I must be the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy. If Gurudev says, then I must be the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy. But then he thinks, and you want to know why I'm the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy? Because he sent me a message to give to the gopis in Vrindavan. And when I saw the gopis in Vrindavan, my pride as the topmost recipient of Krishna's, my pride as the greatest devotee, because he was known as the greatest, was crushed to dust. So that's why I'm the greatest. That's why I'm the topmost recipient of Krishna's mercy, because I saw that level of love. And then he tells Narada Muni, let's stop this talk right now. Because Krishna started to remember the residents of Vrindavan last night, and he hasn't gone back for so long that he hasn't even been able to get out of bed. He's sleeping in bed. The Supreme Personality of Godhead can't get out of bed. And he has the covers over his head. And he can't get out of bed. And he's in this state of complete separation from the gopis, the residents of Vrindavan. So you better curb your eagerness, Narada Muni. You better curb your eagerness, Narada Muni. So you see how brilliant it is, how it's pointing to the greatness of the gopis, because Uddhava now is pointing to the greatness of the gopis and the residents of Vrindavan. And Krishna himself is in separation from them. But then Rohini says, wait a second. I don't want to hear about Krishna's love for the gopis. Because when he left Vrindavan, they nearly died. And I came and I told him very carefully, and he did nothing. So don't tell me that Krishna loves the gopis. Because Krishna did nothing. When I saw Mother Yasoda's separation and love, and I saw how her heart was broken, and he didn't do anything. So don't tell me that Krishna has love for the residents of Vrindavan. He hasn't given up. I don't go for that. And then Krishna's chaste wife, Rukmini. Because she hears Rohini say, look, he didn't go back, he doesn't have... She says, well, I'm his wife and I know how much he loves. You know how much he loves the residents of Vrindavan? I'm sleeping next to him at night and all of a sudden I hear him call, Pingala, Rakta, Kala. He's calling all his different cows at night. He's sleeping right next to me. And if that's not bad enough, he starts calling the gopis, and while he's resting, he goes into a threefold bending form. So you're gonna tell me he doesn't love the residents of Vrindavan? You see how much he loves the residents of Vrindavan? To make a long story short, no, because I can do this every time in Jersey, because Jersey's a Rasika place. A lot of Rasika bhaktas in New Jersey. I couldn't tell this confidential pastimes in New York. Too much Aishwarya. This is like for Jersey. So, to make a long story short for today, somehow or other, in the midst of all of this, I didn't even look at the book once. I should have once, but in the midst, when I come here, I'll do Brihat Bhagavatamrita. Then what happened is, somehow Krishna gets up, and there's a discussion with Balaram, because Balaram also went back, and there's this sense, there's an understanding why Krishna didn't go back. That becomes clear in the story. There's reasons why Krishna didn't go back. Not that he didn't love the gopis. He loved them so much he didn't go back. But that's a very deep subject. But what happens is, and is a very, is that Balaram and Krishna start talking about the pain of the residents of Vrindavan. And Krishna grabs the neck of Balaram, kind of like for shelter, because he's so distressed. And they both fall on the floor. And they become completely unconscious. Now there's an existential crisis. Because if God dies, nothing exists. So there's an existential crisis. Interesting story, Madhavi?
Yeah.
It's really kind of got a lot of... You should read this book. You'd really, really love it. It'd be like, it's so exciting, Brihat Bhagavatamrita. That's only one section, there's two sections. The other section is also amazing, about Gop Kumar. But, so what happens is, now, when there's love, this term priti or love, the goal is priti, P-R-I-T-I. What priti or love means is when your satisfaction is the enjoyment of another. Fully. So when you have love of Godhead, your happiness becomes God's pleasure. And your sadness becomes God's sadness. So when Krishna and Balaram are lying there in that condition, the whole Dwarka starts to wail, because everybody's running there. What's going on? Because you have to remember, Krishna is Krishna. It means that he is the most attractive person. So he's infinitely attractive. So whatever affection or infatuation you had for anyone else, multiply it by a trillion times. That's what it feels to love Krishna. And that's Krishna's mercy, that he becomes the object of the greatest love. And because that's his pleasure, he loves you. Because you love the person who loves you. You enjoy love from someone who loves you, who you love. Right? If Donald Trump came in here and gave you a hug, you wouldn't, maybe wouldn't be excited. how did I just bring the whole lot to just bring the whole story, right? Why do I do this? I was on the high. That guy gets into every wave in Krishna Leela. So Krishna loves so much, and they love Krishna. So what to do? So this actually calls for an intervention from Lord Brahma, the engineer creator of the particular universe, who comes and then has this idea that the only way to revive Krishna from his separation from the gopis is to convince him that he's in union with them again. So there's an architect for the demigods called Vishvakarma, and outside of Dwarka he built New Vrindavan. Nava Vrindavan is called. That's where Prabhupada got the term New Vrindavan from Brihat Bhagavatamrita. So they built an exact replica. So they, Garuda has his, Lord Brahma has his swan, and they take Balaram and Krishna, and they carry them, and they bring him to New Vrindavan. And then they put him down, and then they decide they're going to like gradually wake him up. So they change him from his kingly cloth to make a turban, and they stick a flute and a buffalo horn and a stick, and they give him a peacock feather, and they're going to do this. So Balaram then gets up and he helps with it. But Lord Brahma tells the queens of Dwarka, if you want to come, you can come, but hide behind the trees, because if he sees you, he'll know this is all fake news. So he so you hide behind the trees. You hide behind the trees and don't say anything. So Krishna, kind of, they finally wake up Krishna. They say, Krishna, Krishna, it's time to take out the cows. It's time. And he kind of like, cows? Cows? How about the cows? So he opens his eyes, and Vishvakarma had duplicated perfectly everything in Vrindavan in wax according to intricate flowers and everything. So it looked exactly like Vrindavan. All the exact flowers, all the exact things. He's kind of duplicated it exactly. Exactly. So Krishna wakes up, and then he's so embarrassed. It's like 11 o'clock. I was supposed to take out the cat. He's so embarrassed. He's so embarrassed. And then he sees his mother, and they put fresh butter in her wax hand, and he grabs and he eats the butter, and he sees that his mother is not moving, and he says, oh my God, she's angry. My mother is angry with me. And then goes and sees the gopis, and they won't talk to him either. But what happens is, when Krishna is with the gopis, the emotion and the love that he's feeling is something that the queens have never saw before. Because they're the queens. They're not the gopis. They have a little bit of a formal thing. They got to worship Pati. their worshipable husband. It's not the same level of love. And Krishna responds to them a little bit formally. So it's not the same level of revelation of his personality. But now they're seeing Akila Rasa Rita Murti, they're seeing the full embodiment of Krishna's love, and they go in ecstasy. Because they really love Krishna, so they're not envious. They just saw their husband more beautiful than ever before. So another glorification of Vrindavan, which is the purpose of the book. So then Krishna goes out to herd the cows with Balaram. Balaram now knows what happened. And he looks, because it's on the Arabian Sea, and he looks in the distance, and he sees like all these palaces of Dwarka. So he's like, what's going on? Like, who am I? What is going on? He doesn't understand. Then Balaram kind of sits him down and tells him what happened and tells him, look, you still have your mission to perform. Yada yadahi dharma syadlanir bhavati bharata. You have your mission to perform. So you have your mission to perform, so you have to perform your mission. And he said, all right, I guess I gotta, everybody else, I have to do my duty. And then Krishna comes back to the palace, and all the queens are there to greet him affectionately, except Satyabhama. Because she has there's different types of love. So there's submissive love and there's contrary love. So Rukmini has the submissive love. And Satyabhama has the contrary love. And Krishna is usually a little bit afraid of Satyabhama. But this time, because her anger is not honoring the glory of the gopis, he says, call Satyabhama. And he says, okay, Satyabhama? You want to know why? You don't want to know? You want to know why, Satyabhama? I'll tell you why, Satyabhama. Actually, you don't know this, but the honeymoon was a perverted reflection of this scene. Well, I'll send you the moon. You want me to go to the moon? Satyabhama, I'll send you. Okay, Satyabhama. And then he tells her about the glories of the gopis. So in this way, so that's chapter 6. Next time in Jersey, I'll tell chapter 7, which is the ultimate. Okay. So, let me see if I fulfilled my obligation. I did. I spoke for over an hour. So, according to the principles of Vaidhi Bhakti, I've done my duty. So, I just want to say, I like Sunday morning programs. I think it's the right time. I think people are free. You know, it's good. So I think what I'll do is I'll ask for reflections, and today we'll end with kirtan because I spoke so long. But anybody have any reflections, anything they remember about the class that struck with them?
Anybody, but Gail.
Okay, Gail, what do you remember about the class?
You got my attention when you redefined authority as being that person whose desires take precedence over your own.
Yeah.
I like that definition.
I do too.
But, you know, and it reminded me also...
Because then the child can be the authority for the and love. Mm-hmm. And it's something above you. So the mother, even though she has a position above the child, she takes a humble position in relationship to the child.
You know what I mean? And it's just, you know, it's a kind of, you know, because authority, you know, it's like the A word, you yeah. know, and so it takes that edge off.
Right.
But it also reminded me of the other time you got my attention when you redefined authority as being that person who has deeper realizations than your own.
Yeah.
So I like that.
Yeah, authority is not just position, it's truth. Mm-hmm. Truth is above us. So if a person has more truth in whatever it is, whether it's music, whether it's dance, whether it's philosophy, whether it's realization, then that person becomes our authority. Yeah, in terms of truth.
Yeah, it just takes that dictatorial connotation off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. As our friend Satya Hari says, that his teacher once told him that words become impregnated with the history of their use. Even names can be, like, ruined. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to be a long while before someone names one of their disciples like Kirtanananda or something. You know, beautiful name. Mm-hmm. But it things like that can happen to things and words. And they're used differently. They're going to be used differently in different cultures.
Servants.
What? Yeah, that realization that I had about how words are used, it's amazing. They can take on even completely different meanings. And they affect your conceptions of things. The revelation that the information I got that the four horsemen of atheism, Dennis, Dawkins, Harris, and Hitchens, they all have problems with their father. So it affects, you know, if you have bad experience with your father, then you have a particular conception of authority. If you had a good experience, you have another perception of authority. So it also has to do with how that word has been applied within your own life. And that's why teaching is such a art and a challenge, because you have to know your audience and you have to use language according to their understanding, not your own. Right? I always say it more important than speaking the truth is having the truth understood. So communication is a very, you know, you have to really know the people.
I have my own, like, personal dictionary at home that, you know, so I translate for myself words that will never, you know, be, how you say, words that I'll never heal from, like, you know, servant, master, you know. There's no way that, you know, I can connect to Krishna using these words.
I know, you have to have your own, yeah. Mara, do you remember anything from the class that struck you?
Yeah, I really loved just all the imagery. Like, just the way that you tell a story, like, it makes it so easy to understand and to, like, see it play out. Like, when Krishna, saw Vrindavan, then, like, all the wax, like, I could, like, see that. I don't know, I just loved that.
Well, because you're an artist, see, a visual is right. So we'll compose a musical. You do the music, and I'll write the lyrics, okay?
Of course.
Good, thank you. That's good, right? Stories are interesting because the stories open your heart. And then if you put the philosophy in, you got an opportunity to really give people philosophy because it just opens their hearts. It's a great story, isn't it?
It's really intricate. You should see when Narada Muni meets Hanuman. Hanuman becomes so excited to see Narada Muni, he like jumps up. Because Narada Muni, their feet don't touch the ground. The demigods, their feet don't touch the ground, so they're flying. And he jumps up and he's so excited, he grabs his neck and they're like spinning around in front of scenes. Anybody else have anything that they...
I was taken with Uddhava's response to Narada Muni's claim that he was the ultimate devotee and how these stories are going on in his head and he's thinking about, well, how about this one? How about that one? How about this one? But if I remember Uddhava got a little carried away with the gopis too when he went to deliver his message, did he not?
He'd become overwhelmed with how advanced they are. He just couldn't believe it. Because he never saw that level of devotion. Because Krishna had left so many years before, and they were still mad in separation. And he sees in a place called Uddhava Kyati, there's a place where Uddhava met the gopis, and Radharani was talking to a bumblebee. And because the bumblebee is dark and Krishna is dark. So in her madness, she said, oh, Krishna sent her message. And she starts to chastise the bumblebee. You are the unreliable servant of an unreliable master. One time, Bhubaneshwar told that to a Kinshana Krishna. When he walked in. Anybody else remember anything?
Yeah, I thought that was interesting what you were saying about like the relationship of the word Muni and Mauna. And
isn't it?
Like it makes good sense with like Kardama Muni.
Right? Kardama Muni, Kapila Muni.
Yeah. But how is it that Narada ended up with that title? Because he's like so contrary to that.
It's described, actually speaking, I don't remember where. It's in one of the Bhagavatam stories. I really have to think deeply that it explains this like explicitly why a devotee, and maybe the story of Akura. If I find it, I'll come down to the cinnamon and snail, and if you give me a few donuts, then I'm glad. I'll gladly give you the answer. But it's one of the purports, and I just, why that refers to a devotee, even though they're chanting it. But I guess the idea is our conception of noise is not any sound. It's sounds that are born of the ego. But sounds of born the soul are not noise. They create harmony. You know, it's just like I went to a temple and they had a waterfall on the altar. You know, kind of like, but I just thought that sound doesn't disturb. But if any mechanical sound disturbs, so things that go against nature disturb, and things that are natural don't. So it's something like that. But there's a specific purpose. I'm curious now. I'm going to look it up. I'll find it for you. You know, about, I think it's in the Uddhava. It describes this point. Amazing. And that's where I got the point of Muni and Mauna. It comes from there, from this same purport. It says there's that Muni means silent. So, yeah, I'm going to find it. I know where it is. It has to do with Uddhava, with Akura. Anybody else have anything they remembered that struck them in the class? Janine, thank you.
When the queens were, who had a, like, sort of more of a distant relationship with Krishna, almost in a way, seeing him in Vrindavan, where he had much more intimate relationships and were truly happy, that their response to that was ecstasy.
Yeah.
That was really sweet.
It was ecstasy as well. They were embracing each other and rolling on the ground behind the trees. They were just in such ecstasy.
Yeah, because they saw their husband even in a more attractive way. But the factor of non-enviousness, except for Satyabhama. Satyabhama, you want to know why I love Radharani? I'll tell you why I want to love Radharani. I'll tell you. Okay. Anything else? Yeah.
When Narada saw that one devotee that made the altar out of the mud and put his shilagram on and was worshiping him, fed everyone, and he was just put his hands together and said that, you know, any benefit that I get from this, I offer it to you.
Wow, yeah, beautiful. Okay, so this is bhakti. Bhakti is spontaneous. So somehow or other, the eagerness of the audience inspired me to speak longer than I was planning in my attempt to control the world. So I had to kind of surrender to what was going on.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that.
Yeah, it was fun. It's good. So give me cartels. I'm going to take out the official cough drops of the Hare Krishna movement. The fisherman friends. I think the owner of this goes back to Godhead. Okay. Where is Jayadev? Anybody else play Madanga here? Tota? Banging around? No? Okay, I'll just do cartels. It's okay. It's okay. No, let's do cartels.
Krishna. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna
shot him upstairs. Before we go upstairs, I just wanted to thank you, Maharaj, for coming here and blessing our house. I always thought when we moved in here that I always wanted to use this space to serve the devotees, and this allowing this to happen. So
wow.
I really appreciate everyone coming here and blessing our home. And I also made a gift for everyone, because I also feel like I should give when devotees are here. So I just wanted to show you, before you leave, you should take one of these. This is a print that I made. This is one for you to also, Maharaj. This is a Gorni tie on the front, and then on the back is Krishna and Balaram.
Wow. Aww.
Aww.
So on the back's Krishna Balaram, and then you turn, and it's turned into Gorni tie.
Ayendra Tattva Bhav. That's amazing. Look at that. Wow.
Thank you.
Very, huh?
So I don't know if you want to take these now or before you go, just make sure you get one. Because when you take prasadam, obviously, may want them.
Yeah.
So one for you also, Mara, before you go. Oh,
they're beautiful. Wow.
So I just feel like I want to be able to use my artistic skill somehow to serve the devotees.
Yeah,
so.
This is amazing stuff. You should do more. It's great. I love this style, right?
Actually, I guess you guys can, if you want to look at it. You can see what he's looking
for. Yeah.
Yeah, this is really great.